Whether you are, prepping for a high stakes meeting, or maybe you're just insanely curious about the fundamental nature of the universe, I really need you to brace yourself today.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Because today we are going to completely rewrite your understanding of reality. Seriously, we actually got our hands on this this leaked document authored by the Post-Human Research Division at Paradox Labs.
Right.
And it's simply titled PARADO X Labs Theory POM.txt. And what is inside is just, it's completely radical. Our mission for this deep dive to explore their incredibly bold new framework that they call the Singularity Atom.
Yeah, and it's a document that it doesn't just tweak standard physics,
Right.
right? It completely overhauls the entire ontology of matter.
Totally.
It really forces us to ask not just what matter is, but why it behaves the way it does, the most fundamental levels. It reframes the very substance that, well, you and I are made of.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want you to picture that classic middle school science poster of an atom. You know the exact one I'm talking
Oh
about.
yeah, the solar system one.
Exactly. It has that big, heavy nucleus sitting in the center, acting like the sun, and you've got these little, brightly colored electrons zooming around it in neat circular planetary orbits. We've all seen it.
We all had to memorize it for tests.
Right. But, well, according to this text, that image is completely fundamentally wrong. It is essentially a pedagogical lie that we've been telling ourselves just to make the math easier to
A
visualize.
useful lie for a really long time, but
Yeah.
still a lie. What this text proposes, and it gets into the actual mechanics of what is happening and why, is that we need to abandon that miniature solar system concept entirely.
Just to throw it out.
Throw it completely out. Instead, we have to reimagine the atom as a binary system of two singularities.
Wow.
Imagine two incredibly dense black hole-like entities locked in this fiercely tight orbit. And they aren't just moving silently through empty space, Their orbit is actually plucking and ringing the very fabric of space-time itself.
That's just wild.
The prologue of the source material actually sets the tone for everything that follows perfectly. It says every atom is a silent gravitational wave observatory.
A silent gravitational wave observatory. That phrase alone gives me chills.
It's poetry, really.
It is. But let's ground this a bit because throwing around words like singularity and black hole, when we are talking about the building blocks of everyday objects, like literally the chair you are sitting on, it's a lot to take in.
Yeah, it's heavy.
We need to start at the center. The text in chapter one calls the nucleus a color horizon. What exactly is happening in the core of an atom to justify calling it a full-blown singularity?
Well, let's look at the mechanics of the nucleus. So, standard physics tells us the nucleus is made of protons and neutrons, which are, themselves made of even smaller particles called quarks.
Right, the quarks.
But there is a massive catch here. Quarks are basically trapped inside the nucleus by the strong nuclear force. They can never exist on their own out in the wild.
Like ever.
Ever. This permanent confinement happens at a very specific boundary, a radius of about one femtometer.
Which is, just to clarify for everyone, unimaginably small. We are talking one quadrillionth of a meter.
Precisely that small. And in this new theory, that boundary, where the quarks are permanently confined, isn't just some arbitrary line drawn by math. It is treated as a literal physical event horizon.
Okay, wait. Like an actual black hole event horizon?
Exactly. Think about how nothing, not even light, can escape a black hole once it crosses the event horizon.
Right.
Here, no information about these quarks, what physicists call the colored degrees of freedom, can escape this one femtometer radius. The nucleus isn't just a cluster of particles, it is a composite singularity bounded by this strong horizon.
And the document points out that this horizon is governed by the strong nuclear force, right?
Yeah.
Which operates mathematically very much like gravity, but it's gravity on an incomprehensible scale.
Yeah, the math is what we call isomorphic, meaning the equations governing this strong force structurally mirror the equations of Einstein's gravity.
Okay.
But the effective coupling constant, which is basically the raw muscle of this strong force, is 10 to the power of 40 times stronger than normal gravity.
10 to the 40.
That is a 1 followed by 40 zeros.
That's just absurd.
It is. But that terrifying strength is the why behind the atom structure. It explains why the nucleus is so overwhelmingly dense. It is literally behaving like a microscopic black hole held together by a force that completely dwarfs standard gravity.
So if the nucleus is this inescapable, terrifyingly strong horizon, what happens when we zoom out to the electron? Because, I mean, standard physics tells us the electron doesn't even have an internal structure,
Right,
right?
it's a point particle.
It's not made of smaller pieces like the proton is,
Yeah.
but chapter two of the text refers to the electron as a quantum horizon.
And that is where the physics gets even stranger.
Yeah.
The electron is incredibly tiny, smaller than 10 to the minus 22 meters.
Okay.
It is a true point-like singularity. However, quantum mechanics prevents it from just being a neat, infinitely small dot.
Because of the uncertainty principle.
Exactly. You cannot pin down the exact location of an electron because of a concept called the Compton wavelength. For the electron, that's a bubble of space about 3.86 times 10 to the minus 13 meters wide.
Let me try to visualize that. The electron is a tiny point, but it has this fuzzy, protective bubble around it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And the text says if you try to poke inside that bubble to see the dot, the universe basically fights back.
Oh, the universe fights back violently. If you try to probe an electron at a scale smaller than its Compton wavelength, you have to pack so much energy into such a tiny space to do it that you literally rip new particles out of the vacuum.
Wait, really?
Yeah, you create an electron-positron pair out of thin air. It's what physicists call a Dirac-C puncture. The sheer energy density of the electron actually tears a hole in the quantum vacuum.
Which means the electron has this fuzzy edge that acts as an absolute barrier. You cannot look inside that fuzzy boundary without breaking the system and, losing information. And losing information behind an impenetrable boundary is the exact definition of a black hole's event horizon.
You've completely nailed the concept.
Yeah.
The text argues this fuzzy edge is a perfect quantum horizon.
Okay, I am going to push back here.
Please do.
Because if I am picturing an electron as a black hole, my brain immediately goes to mass. If every atom in my body, or in the table I am resting my arms on right now, is made of tiny black holes.
Right, the vacuum cleaner analogy.
Yes. Shouldn't my table be like a cosmic vacuum cleaner trying to suck up the entire universe? I mean, why aren't we all instantly crushed into a singularity?
That is a fantastic, necessary question, and it's a hurdle the authors of this framework completely anticipated. If you try to calculate the mass of this electron black hole
Cool.
using standard Newtonian gravity, the regular gravity that keeps our feet on the ground,
Yeah.
the electron would have to weigh what we call the Planck mass.
Okay, give me a real-world equivalent for the Planck mass. How heavy is that?
It is about 10 to the minus 8 kilograms.
Which sounds tiny to us.
It sounds tiny, but for a single subatomic particle, it is astronomically huge. It is roughly the weight of a fleet packed into a single indivisible point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. If every single electron weighed as much as a flea, the universe would have collapsed the moment it was born. But here's the genius pivot in the theory.
Okay.
The electron is not a gravitational black hole. It is an electromagnetic one.
Ah, so it's pulling with an entirely different force. It's a different brand of vacuum cleaner.
Completely different brand. Its horizon isn't governed by Newton's gravitational constant. It is governed by something called the fine structure constant, which dictates how charged particles interact with light.
Okay, I'm following.
The electron's event horizon is simply the scale at which its own intense electromagnetic field back reacts on itself to create those new vacuum particles. It's a charged black hole in the electromagnetic field, not a gravitational black hole bending giant swaths of space-time.
That is so clever.
Right. It brilliantly resolves the mass issue while allowing the mathematical framework of a singularity to perfectly survive.
That makes perfect sense. So we have our two players, the massive strong horizon in the middle, and the fuzzy charged quantum horizon of the electron on the outside.
Exactly.
But that immediately raises a massive causal question for me. If we have two singularities orbiting each other like binary black holes, why don't they spiral inward and crash?
The collapse problem.
Yeah, we see binary black holes out in deep space doing this all the time. They orbit, they bleed off energy, and they violently merge. Why doesn't the atom just collapse in on itself and shatter the universe?
It's the core puzzle of atomic stability. And in chapter 3, and again in chapter 11, the text answers this. In standard textbook physics, we just wave our hands and say, well, quantum rules dictate the electron can't lose any more energy, so it stays put.
Right, it just is what it is.
Exactly. It's an observation, not a mechanism. But this document gives us a physical causal mechanism. It all comes down to how the proton acts as a color superconductor.
A superconductor. Normally, I mean, I think of floating magnets or zero electrical resistance. How does a proton act as a superconductor?
Well, think about what a normal superconductor does. If you place a magnet over a superconducting material, the material entirely expels the magnetic field, forcing the magnet to levitate.
Right.
It creates a physical barrier the field cannot penetrate. In this theory, the tightly confined nucleus expels the electric fields of the electron. Because of the extreme nature of the strong force horizon we talked about earlier, the electron's quantum wave function is physically excluded from entering the nucleus.
So, returning to our middle school poster, that planetary orbit illusion is totally shattered. It's not a planet lazily circling a star.
Not at all.
It's two incredibly powerful entities actively repelling each other. The proton's horizon physically kicks out the electron's horizon. They literally cannot overlap.
They are locked in a violent but delicate equilibrium. The inward pull of their attraction is perfectly canceled by the outward push of this exclusion principle. And this equilibrium sits at a very specific distance, the Bohr radius, which is about half an angstrom wide. In the Paradox-Lang axioms in the document, this perfectly balanced state is called a shared collapse manifold.
A shared collapse manifold.
Yeah.
So they haven't just found a stable orbit. They've found a physical sweet spot in the vacuum of space where falling inward and pushing outward cancel each other out to minimize the system's total chaos or entropy.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is that the text refers to it as a stationary limit cycle. They're forever falling toward each other, but constantly repelled by their respective event horizons.
That is a wildly dynamic picture of matter. But if they are locked in this endless high-energy dance, they must be affecting the environment around them. I mean, when a heavy boat spins in a lake, it creates a wake. What happens to the space around these singularities when they orbit?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the wake they leave behind is actually the foundation of reality as we perceive it.
Okay, lay it on me.
As the quantum singularity of the electron orbits the core, it plows through the quantum vacuum. And the quantum vacuum is this bubbling soup of virtual particles popping in and out of existence everywhere in space.
Right.
It polarizes them. Standard physics calls this vacuum polarization.
Mm-hmm.
But this framework goes a massive step further. Instead of just treating this as a mathematical cloud of virtual particles, the text frames this polarization as actual physical space-time strain.
Space-time strain. You're saying they are literally bending and stretching the fabric of the universe on a microscopic scale.
They're generating atomic gravitational waves.
Mm.
The mathematics used in the document to describe these vacuum fluctuations are absolutely identical to the math we use to describe the gravitational waves emitted by two massive black holes colliding in deep space.
Identical math.
Identical. The only difference is the scale. These atomic waves are infinitesimally small, and they are mediated by the electromagnetic fine structure constant instead of standard gravity.
Look, I love a beautifully elegant theory as much as anyone, but I have to play the skeptic here.
That's fair.
This math sounds incredibly poetic, but does it actually map onto the real world? Reinterpreting the quantum vacuum as a medium for microscopic gravitational waves is a massive, towering leap. How do we know this isn't just incredible science fiction dressed up in complex equations?
It's a necessary skepticism.
Uh-huh.
But the text doesn't shy away from reality, actually. It is deeply grounded in observable, heavily verified phenomena.
Okay.
In chapters 6 and 8, the authors take famous quantum effects that we've been measuring for decades and show how they slot perfectly into this binary singularity model without changing the empirical data at all. Let's look at the famous Lamb shift.
For anyone whose advanced physics is a little rusty, the Lamb shift is a tiny, incredibly subtle difference in the energy levels of a hydrogen atom, specifically between its 2s and 2p electron states.
Right.
And standard quantum electrodynamics says it's caused by the electron interacting with those random vacuum fluctuations we just mentioned.
Exactly. The document doesn't dispute the measurement, but it completely reinterprets the cause. It frames the Lamb shift as a gravitational memory effect.
A memory effect in the vacuum. Wait, so the vacuum remembers. How does that work?
Imagine walking across a perfectly smooth trampoline. As you step, the fabric bends. When you lift your foot, most of the fabric snaps back perfectly.
Okay, I'm with you.
But imagine that your footsteps leave tiny, permanent micro deformations in the elasticity of the trampoline. Over time, the surface retains a memory of where you walked. In this theory, as the electron singularity orbits, it doesn't just pass through the vacuum cleanly. It leaves a permanent microscopic deformation in the geometry of the vacuum after every single pass.
That is such a brilliant way to visualize it. So that tiny, unexplained shift in energy we've been measuring for decades isn't just random quantum noise.
No.
It is the physical footprint left behind in the vacuum by the electron's orbit. It's actual space-time geometry.
And they apply this exact same logic to the Casimir-Polder force.
Oh, that's the bizarre phenomenon where if you place two uncharged metal plates incredibly close to each other in a total vacuum, they magically push or pull on each other. Standard theory says the vacuum fluctuations are bouncing off the plates, creating pressure.
But the singularity atom theory argues this force is actually a macroscopic tidal interaction. Just like the gravity of the moon reaches out and creates tidal forces that pull the water in Earth's oceans, the atomic singularities inside the metal are reaching out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they create microscopic tidal forces in space-time that pull on the boundary of the opposing plate. It converts a mysterious quantum pressure into a straightforward geometric tidal force.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because it's one thing to look backward in time and come up with a clever new explanation for old experiments, but a real theory has to predict the future.
And it does. Chapter 7 and 14 make some wild predictions.
Yeah. The text claims that if you get a large enough group of these atoms acting together, something called a Bose-Einstein condensate of about a trillion atoms, they could theoretically emit actual macroscopic gravitational waves.
The numbers are astonishing. A single atom's wave emission is practically zero, around 10 to the minus 45 watts. You could never measure it.
Right.
But when you create a Bose-Einstein condensate, you cool atoms down to just above absolute zero, forcing them to sync up and share the exact same quantum state.
So instead of the trillion atoms acting randomly, their individual gravitational ripples start compounding. But how does syncing them up multiply the power so drastically?
Think of a massive sports stadium filled with 100,000 people clapping randomly. It's just a messy roar of white noise, right?
Sure.
The sound waves cancel each other out. But if all 100,000 people clap in perfect rhythmic unison, the sound waves stack. It creates a thunderous, unified shockwave that can shake the concrete.
Oh, I see.
When a trillion atomic singularities sync their orbits in a condensate, their tiny space-time deformations stack coherently. The power scales exponentially, jumping all the way to 10 to the minus 20 watts.
And the text suggests that while that is still a faint signal, it could theoretically be detected by instruments we are currently building, like the LISA detectors. We are building massive space-based laser interferometers to listen for supermassive black holes crashing together in distant galaxies. And this text suggests we could tune that exact same technology to listen to atoms in a lab.
The implications for material science alone are staggering here. I mean, the document even redefines something as mundane as heat. We already know about phonons, which are just the units of vibrational energy that carry sound or heat through a solid object, like a crystal or a metal bar.
Right. If I strike a tuning fork, the ringing traveling through the metal is carried by phonons.
This text proposes that those everyday phonons are actually atomic gravitational waves that have been confined within the rigid structure of the crystal lattice.
Let's test that logic. Okay. You're telling me that when I pour hot coffee into a ceramic mug and the heat travels from the inside of the mug to my hand, the heat transfer is fundamentally a gravitational wave phenomenon.
Essentially, yes.
That the atoms are ringing the space-time inside the ceramic.
That is the exact argument. The atoms aren't just vibrating in space. They are rippling the space-time between them. At the surface of the mug, those internal ripples leak out as real gravitational radiation. It frames the entirety of solid-state physics, every circuit board, every piece of metal, as an active laboratory of quantum gravity.
If this theory manages to redefine matter this fundamentally, then it really forces a reckoning with our place within it. I mean, we are made of matter. Our brains are made of atoms.
And this brings us to part V of the document, philosophical implications. And this is where the text asks us to completely discard our classical intuitions about reality. They introduce the idea of the atom as a holographic screen.
The word hologram usually brings up images of, like, a sci-fi movie projecting a glowing 3D image from a flat tabletop. How does an atom act like a holographic screen?
Conceptually, it comes back to black holes again. In advanced astrophysics, there is a widely accepted principle that all the three-dimensional information about whatever falls into a black hole is perfectly encoded on its two-dimensional surface, the event horizon.
Right, it's stored on the boundary.
Exactly. This text applies that exact holographic principle to the atom. It suggests that all the internal information of this binary system, the states of the nucleus and the electron, is encoded entirely on the boundary of that shared collapse manifold we discussed earlier, the Bohr radius.
Meaning the atom itself is a microscopic screen projecting the illusion of what we call quantum chemistry. Every atom in my body is a tiny holographic projector.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the most controversial part of the document. Chapter 19. I have to bring this up because it feels like the text takes a massive leap from physics into philosophy here. They speculate about human consciousness.
The microtubule connection.
Whoa, hang on. I was completely with you for the atoms and the ceramic mugs, but the text argues that inside our brains, we have these structural filaments called neural microtubules. And it suggests that if the atoms inside these microtubules oscillate together coherently, just like in that Bose-Einstein condensate, they could create macroscopic ripples in space-time inside our heads. It implies that human consciousness itself might literally be a gravitational wave effect.
It's a lot.
I need to push back heavily here. How does the text justify jumping from atoms or tiny black holes to my internal monologue is bending space-time?
This raises an incredibly important question, and you know the authors know how speculative this is. I encourage you to critically think about this and maintain that skepticism. The jump from atomic forces to human sentience is massive.
It really is.
But look at the underlying philosophical shift it demands of the reader. We're deeply conditioned to think of matter as things sitting in an empty void of space, like marbles resting in a glass bowl.
Yeah.
This theory says that entire paradigm is wrong. Matter is not sitting in space-time. Matter is space-time interacting with itself.
So a thought isn't just an electrical spark traveling through a wire in a void. A thought is a resonant ripple in the fabric of the universe itself, because the brain is fundamentally made of that fabric.
Precisely. It frames consciousness not as a ghost in the machine, but as a direct, geometric feature of reality.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive talking about lies on middle school science posters. But now I want you, the listener, to do something. The next time you sit down and touch a wooden desk or wrap your hands around a steering wheel or even just rest your chin in your hand, I want you to imagine what is actually happening under your fingertips.
It's incredible to think about.
You are not touching solid, inert balls of matter. You are pressing against a vast, humming network of binary singularities. You are feeling the pushback of billions of tiny, fuzzy quantum horizons aggressively repelling billions of dense, inescapable core horizons.
Exactly.
With every single atomic transition, you are warping the quantum vacuum. The universe isn't a box full of tiny parts. It is a continuous, violently vibrating lattice of dancing singularities.
And that leads to one final, deeply profound thought from the end of the document, chapter 20, a section they call the final singularity.
Okay.
If all matter in the universe is just a vast network of these tiny individual atomic singularities, what happens when you push reality to its ultimate extreme? I want you to ponder this. At the exact moment of the Big Bang, when the entire universe was infinitely dense, or maybe deep inside the crushing core of a massive galactic black hole, what happens to those atomic horizons?
Do they break?
The text suggests they merge. Under infinite pressure, do all these billions of individual microscopic event horizons fuse back together into one single unified horizon?
Wow.
Because if they do, that is the exact point where quantum electrodynamics, quantum chromodynamics, and general relativity are no longer separate rules of nature. At that extreme edge of reality, they are finally perfectly the exact same thing.
A silent gravitational wave observatory collapsing backward into the ultimate unified singularity. We leave you to chew on that thought.